The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Today we look back at the life of Diego Maradona, a footballing genius who has died at the age of 16. He went from poverty in Buenos Aires to lifting the World Cup in Mexico 86. He led Napoli to their first Serie A title in 1987, and again 3 years later, along with the UEFA Cup and a Coppa Italia. His incredible fame transcended sport, but came at a huge personal cost. Off the pitch, he suffered from excess and addiction, but he did more in 60 years than most of us could do in two lifetimes. This is The Guardian Football Weekly, paying tribute to Diego Maradona. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, Jonathan Wilson and Filippo Clare. Marcela Mora y Araujo will join us from Buenos Aires in part two. And Asif Kapadia, the director of the Maradona film, will be here for part three. Chaps, it probably didn't come as a surprise necessarily, but still a shock, if that makes any sense. Philippe, what was your reaction?
Yes, a shock, but not a surprise. But at the same time, I think... We'd been quite relieved when we'd heard, you know, he'd been hospitalized not that long ago when he had some bleeding on the brain. And we thought, oh, no, oh, no. And he pulled through this. And you thought, well, this man is simply indestructible. And I think, like most people yesterday, I think when the news first came through, I thought, we've got to be so careful with this. We've got to be so careful with this. And I think it is still sinking in, really. I think for all of us, and we are there looking at those pictures and watching the videos and reading about him, and in a way still thinking or feeling that we're talking about somebody else, that he's still around. And in a way, I suppose he will always be around. And, you know, it might sound a bit maudlin to say that, but if there's a player who is destined to be here for all eternity, it is Diego Maradona. But yeah, it's not a surprise, I suppose you could say that, but a huge shock.
Baz?
I was shocked. I was kind of, well, I wasn't surprised by how sad it made me feel, but I more or less immediately went and watched the documentary we'll be talking about later again. I've seen it a few times now, and God, he was such a player, wasn't he? And such a guy, obviously very flawed, had a lot of shortcomings, as do we all, but... If I had to go age 60, and I may well do, if not before, I'd be happy to check out with a similar kind of CV to the one Diego Maradona has.
You have to do quite a lot of work in the next 13 years, I'd point out, Barry, to do that. Jonathan, I know you've done, I mean, countless interviews for, you know, networks all over the world, which says something, doesn't it? That you know, everyone is so fascinated by this guy.
Yeah,
have you had time to sort of process it yourself?
No, not at all. We're recording this, 16 hours after the news of his death was revealed. I've been working for 13 of those and asleep for three. So I'm still sort of in that work mode. Obviously 60 is far too young for anybody, but in a sense, it is good that his final year wasn't some awful lingering illness. He was working as manager of Gimnasia La Plata, and he was going around Argentinian stadiums being hailed by fans everywhere. I think the most touching of those tributes came at Newell's. So he only played seven games for Newell's, five league games, seven games in total. And you know, I feel like I say this regularly, but there's something very odd about Argentinian history. The thing doesn't feel real. It feels written. And so on his debut for Newell's, at half time, they had a six-year-old boy did tricks on the pitch with a ball. Lionel Messi. How weird is that? But yeah, so he went back to Newell's where he'd barely played, and fans had made a throne for him in Newell's colours. And so rather than sitting on the bench in the technical area, he sat on a throne by the touchline.
Amazing.
And that was at the extreme end of the tributes that were being paid to him. But every ground he went to, every away ground he went to over the last year and a bit, there was a celebration of him. So at least he had that.
Look, I'd like to talk in part one about how brilliant a footballer he was and some of his great moments on the pitch. But Wilson, you wrote a piece for The Guardian yesterday, or it's in the paper today, I saw it online yesterday, talking about where he came from. And I don't think everyone will know, like, how humble his roots were.
Oh, yeah. And that is, of course, part of what makes him so central to the Argentinian mythos. And I think that's the thing that people have to understand. I think it's quite difficult if you don't spend time in Argentina, that Argentina is a country where the football team is utterly central to notions of self. That Argentina, as the First World War begins and the British influence wanes, it's a country that's looking for its identity. It's an immigrant country. The indigenous populations have been wiped out in what was essentially a genocide in the late 19th century. And so you have Italians, Spaniards, Northern European Jews, Arabs, a handful of British, Irish, French, German. This mass of people with very little in common, trying to work out what binds us, what makes us Argentinian. And the thing they all do have is they all support this football team that wears the blue and white striped shirt. And so the way that team plays becomes very directly relevant to national character. So there's this ongoing debate through the 1920s as to what that national character should be and how that should be represented in football. And if I can just read this out, I find this incredible. So in 1928, the editor of El Gráfico, Boicotto, wrote that if a statue is to be erected to the soul of the Argentinian game, it would depict a pibe, so an urchin child, a pibe with a dirty face, a mane of hair rebelling against the comb, with intelligent, roving, trickster and persuasive eyes, and a sparkling gaze that seemed to hint at a picaresque laugh, but does not quite manage to form on his mouth, full of small teeth that might be worn down through eating yesterday's bread. His trousers are a few roughly sewn patches, his vest with Argentinian stripes, with a very low neck, with many holes eaten out by the invisible mites of use. His knees covered with the scabs of wounds disinfected by fate, barefoot or with shoes whose holes in the toes suggest it must have been made through too much shooting. His stance must be characteristic. It must seem as if he is dribbling with a rag ball. Now, if you gave that to somebody and didn't give them a context and said, who's that? They would all tell you it's Maradona. And that's 50 years before he made his international debut. So his coming was foretold. He's not just a great footballer. He's a great footballer in the absolute image of Argentina's self-image of what an Argentinian footballer should be. And bound up in that is a sense of viveza, of cunning, of wit. And that again, is crucial to national character. That Boicotto and the great thinkers of El Gráfico, they realise that the soul of Argentinian football lies in Potreros, in the vacant lots of the rapidly growing city. And you'd had the British had dominated football between 1890 and 1912. But their football was football that had been taught in the big public schools with their great playing fields on grass where running and strength was key. The Argentinian game is from the streets. It's from technique. It's from being able to control the ball in a tight space when you've got too many players in a too small a space, when the ground is uneven, and when you've got to have this smartness and this streetwiseness to survive because you don't have a teacher there blowing a whistle. You don't have somebody there saying, no, you can't do that, because in the streets you can do anything. You've got to be able to look after yourself. And so the fact that his defining game, certainly from an Argentina point of view, is against England in 1986, and his two goals are the two sides of Bibesa. There's the cunning of a handball and then the cunning of the brilliance of a technique for the second goal. Everything he did was fulfilling the prophecy.
Shall we go home now?
Yeah, I mean, that was brilliant, Wilson. Can we talk then about some amazing moments on the pitch? Barry, I don't know what sticks out. I mean, I obviously went to 86 and I went to every commentary of the second goal. You know, Barry Davis, who is obviously one of the best. Brian Butler on radio. I had a goals video, 500 greatest goals, which I think was narrated by Michael Caine. But the Brian Butler commentary comes in and it has this sort of weird music, sort of soft music behind it. And it's Brian Butler going, you know, leaves Butcher for dead, leaves Fenwick for dead. And that's why he's the greatest in the world. And I saw an Irish commentator, I forget his name now, you'll know it, who just goes...
Jimmy McGee.
That's class. And then... that's class again, but said in a totally different way. And I mean, that for me is just, you know, that is peak Maradona. I can't really remember where I was. I must have been at home. I remember seeing it. But just what a goal, what control, what poise.
Well, he described the football as the most beautiful toy. And he completely mastered it. And his touch, his technique were amazing. Without wanting to sound all Abraham Simpson, what younger listeners will have to realise is that back then, the 82 World Cup was the first one I was kind of aware of. The 86 one was the first one I took an active interest in. And most of the players, or a huge number of the players, were like aliens who'd come down from other planets, because all the best players didn't play in Europe. There wasn't much football on television. So most of these guys from these exotic countries I was only barely aware of, you'd never seen them before because there wasn't a huge amount of football on TV. And so you're just mesmerized by an awful lot of them. But this little hairy runt from Argentina was just the standout player of all of them. And it being Ireland, everyone wanted England to get beaten by Argentina. So I do remember, I have a vague recollection at the time, just the national celebrations and people suggesting that Maradona should be made an honorary Irish citizen and all that. But and, you know, as childish as that may sound, that's just the way it was. But he was, in that World Cup, I've never seen anyone tear up a World Cup like he did in 1986. And when he's a guy you've never heard of before, never seen before. And I think in his career, he participated in four World Cups, played a sort of active role in two, got to two finals, got sent home from his final one. And then I think he was always aggrieved he wasn't invited or picked for the 78 one. So despite spending a huge amount of his career being a drug addict, he could have played and probably should have participated in five different World Cups, which would have been quite astonishing.
So much is said about the hand of God, isn't it, Philippe? And you know, half our listeners are in the UK and half aren't. And I wonder if the rest of the world doesn't care about that handball. And you know, obviously, like, four front pages have that handball, you know, in the papers today. And it's an amazing photo, right? And an iconic moment.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's a tiny part of Maradona.
It's both tiny and huge because, you know, as Jonathan has said, the game in a way encapsulated who he was on the pitch and also perhaps who he was off the pitch. More about this later. But I think it's quite telling that, you know, we were all preparing. I mean, with France Football, we did a special issue for his 60th birthday. We also did one for Josimar. And it was obvious to us that was in France and in Norway, that we would have to give a very special place to that particular game. So, which is why we talked, you know, to Trevor Stephen and to Gary Lineker. We didn't talk to Peter Shilton. And we talked to as many people as possible who were there at the stadium, because it is a game that is absolutely crucial in defining a player. And I think there is no great player who has been as defined by one game as Diego Maradona. Of course, Pelé, you could say it was, you know, the final against, or it was 1970 World Cup, the final against Italy, or this and this and that. And he dominated this World Cup like maybe Maradona, the 1986, though he had better players around him. But that wouldn't be quite true. I want to come back to what Barry was saying about not seeing much of him, because I genuinely do think it's a major part of the mystique. And I'm older than Barry, so I was old enough to remember the 78 and the 82 World Cup. At the 82 World Cup, what I remember of Maradona is him being beaten, you know, black and blue by Gentile in the 2-1 defeat against Italy, when I think he was fouled 23 times.
I think your cat is very upset about that.
Yeah, the cat is very upset.
Gentile's treatment of Maradona.
And the cat is absolutely right. It was a scandal. And you know what was a scandal as well? And I think we have to say this, and you have to cut me at some point, is that Gentile was interviewed a number of times about that game. And he said something like, football is not for ballerinas, meaning that players like Diego Maradona are to be man-marked and kicked out of the game. And one of the things that has to be said when we were talking about, you know, his greatest moments on the pitch and talking about the game against England, the greatest moments on the pitch were very often the games in which he showed the most courage, which is the opposite of what the Gentiles of this world and the Goicoechea's of this world were showing to him, which was cowardice. Big man hurting little man who were far better than they were. And when you watch again the images, and again, you have to stop me at some point, one thing which really astounded me was, one, his falling technique when he was fouled was absolutely amazing and beautiful. He had a way to sort of, he didn't spring like a salmon, but there was this kind of a whiplash action of his back, oh, and his hair flew in there. But then he hit the ground and he was up within half a second, which is why when he was kicked by Goiko Echea, you knew it was really bad because he didn't get up. I'm mixing everything, but I think that's the right way to do, because Maradona is a mix anyway of things. I think the game against Belgium was better. It had all the elements in terms of pure technique on a better surface as well. That once again, the one against England, which was absolutely appalling, which was like those, you know, those backyards in Lanús where he grew up. This was for me
on a better pitch. Fenwick would have had him, wouldn't he? And he would have scored a great goal.
Well, you know the story, by the way, that when he was about to score against England, the second goal, he could see, I think it's Terry Butcher coming out the corner of his eye, and he carried on because that's the bravery defines the man and the player. And he knew he was going to get clattered, and he thought, and Maradona thought, it doesn't matter because if he clatters me, he will have to clatter the ball into the net. What a man.
Dan says, in the greatest all-time 11, what formation do you play, but can you fit Pelé, Messi and Maradona in, and who gets the number 10 shirt?
No, I'm playing a 4-4-2, and none of them get in, I'm sorry, but this don't fit the system.
there's a great story from Miguel Delaney. I mean, there are, obviously, if you are on social media or you read any paper, there are so many brilliant stories, but Miguel Delaney saying, before the 1990 World Cup opener, some of the Cameroonian players started crying when they saw him in the tunnel. They just couldn't believe they were on the same pitch as him. Just, you know, the global reach of Maradona is extraordinary, isn't it?
And then they went out and kicked the shit out of him.
Well, there is that. But, I mean, they kicked more of the shit out of Caniggia, if we're honest, you know. Right, that'll do for part one. Marcelo Mora y Araujo will join us in Buenos Aires in a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's bring in Marcelo Mora y Araujo, is in Buenos Aires, a friend of the pod, of course. Marcelo, thanks so much for doing this. I know it's very early in Argentina at the moment. Having seen you when Argentina have gone out of a World Cup and how much that affected you, how are you today?
We haven't gone out of a World Cup. I think that's important. So this feels like actually very real and quite different to a football event. I think this is a real loss and a real surprise in many ways, although of course Maradona was unwell for some time, so it's not, it shouldn't really be that surprising, but it felt a little bit shocking and painful. And really, the kind of slow motion unfolding of the city and perhaps the country in mourning has been quite interesting. So throughout the night, crowds have flocked to the various points in the city. Some are queuing to go into the government house where his body has been transported. The body was driven through the city in the middle of the night with massive police escort. And the traditional football fans, the football crowds, have been gathering at the obelisk, which is the kind of landmark place where football joy and sorrow is usually celebrated by masses of people. So in that respect, it feels a little bit like a World Cup event. But really, there's something more profound going on. And I think it's difficult to describe, but you can sense it.
I don't know how big a question this is, but what does Maradona mean to you?
I think there's a strange sense that he embodies bigger things. And, you know, the headlines here are the saddest news ever, Diego's gone. I mean, everything is very dramatic and extreme. And you can sense people here have been in very, very strict lockdown since March. Some people are probably going out for the very first time in months to mourn and weep and pay respects to Maradona in the government house, and have maybe lost relatives or loved ones that they haven't gone to mourn or gone to a funeral or have had people close to them die alone. So it's a very strange time historically, I think. And I'm saying this in all seriousness, I think if you ask me seriously, what does Maradona mean to me? He means to me a symbol of our times, always, for better or for worse. Things that happen around Diego are bigger than Diego, always, and have been for as long as I can remember, which is my whole life.
Marcella, his personal trainer, Fernando Signorini, said there was Diego and there was Maradona. With Diego, I would go to the end of the world. With Maradona, I wouldn't take a step. Is it Diego that will be remembered, or Maradona, or a combination of both in Buenos Aires and Argentina?
I don't know how easy it is to disentangle the two. I love that distinction Signorini makes, because he's known him very, very well for such a long time. He was able to say, okay, Diego, now we're going to train somewhere difficult and hard and drive him miles and miles to a kind of awful place where he'd be away from the limelight and the cameras. And Diego would say, where have you brought me to? And Signorina would go, I've brought you back to the slum, get running. And they were able to communicate like this. So I wouldn't dismiss Signorini's distinction. I think we all know Maradona, we all see Maradona, and we all dream and have a secret kind of wish to get to know Diego, knowing that probably if only we could just reach Diego, it would all be okay, and he would like us, and we could be their friend. But I think actually Diego and Maradona are very much part of the same thing. We almost use Maradona as an adjective in Argentina. Something is Maradonian or Maradonic, and it's not necessarily a good thing. It just kind of means a massive, out-of-control thing.
I mean, you mentioned that there is... I was reading Matt Dickinson in The Times, who's writing a book about Maradona, saying there is the Iglesia Maradiana, the Church of Maradona, and his Maradona's eldest daughter agreed to attend a meeting of them in a restaurant, and two people there suddenly got married using El Diego, his autobiography, like it was a Bible, putting their hands on the autobiography of Maradona to say their vows. I mean, it's extraordinary, that, isn't it? Philippe, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, Marcela, when did Diego become Maradona in Argentina? And if it's possible to put a date on that, and why? I mean, two big questions, but when did he... was it when he was Argentinos? Was it when he went to Barca? Was it the World Cup? Was there a moment which was decisive in this regard?
I think he became Maradona very young, to be honest. Very young. I mean, he was Pelusa, and he was a kid who was good, but he was Diego Maradona. 1978 World Cup. He had already played several games with the main team, the adult team, before the World Cup. And Menotti didn't call him to the final squad because he felt he was a little bit young and green. But he was definitely not an unknown quantity. He was one of our most talented emerging players. And he was well known. By 1979, when he won the Youth World Cup, which, again, was historic, Menotti had managed the first adult team to a World Cup victory and then demoted himself to be the manager of the youth category because he wanted to work with Maradona and took Maradona and took the Youth World Cup seriously. It was played in Tokyo, a final in Tokyo back then. And by then, we as a nation had already got the entire kind of euphoria of the 1978 World Cup on our backs. Complicated set of emotions because the country was in turbulent political times, but that had been great fun and we loved it and it unified everybody in a sense. And so we had this introduction to international football with this chap Maradona. It wasn't like he was Diego and then somehow he turned into Maradona. He was already Diego Maradona. And he already, very shortly after that, he was $1 million transfer, and he joined Boca, and he wore fur coats and earrings, and he had flamboyant parties and birthdays and weddings. So the guy who went to Boca was already Maradona, and the guy who went from Boca to Barcelona was already not just Maradona, but the $6 million man, the nuclear option, the Astro out of asteroid, out of this world. He was just immense. So I can't think of a time when he wasn't. Perhaps if you see footage of a little boy playing keepy uppy in between, you know, between matches or on TV shows, interviews of him dreaming to one day play for Argentina or win the World Cup, you wouldn't say, oh, that's Maradona the superstar. But I suspect he really was already sort of Maradona. Anybody who saw him said, oh, he's the best player we've ever seen.
There's a really interesting question about why we forgive heroes excesses that we don't necessarily forgive others. And you know, you can't separate Diego and Maradona. And, you know, that, you know, there are stories off the pitch that he was incredibly flawed, Jonathan. I don't know why. It's a very big question. And I don't know what the answer is. But it is interesting that you have to accept a person as their whole, I guess, and he gave more than he took necessarily. I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, it makes me a little bit uncomfortable that we are so quick to forgive. And that's not just an issue with Maradona. I think it's an issue with George Best, with Brian Clough. And maybe actually the right answer is we should be more forgiving of everybody. But I also think one of the reasons why Maradona touched so many people and why, you know, I think the affection for him will always be deeper than that for Messi, is that his genius seems much more harder earned. You know, he struggled with it. Whereas Messi has this relentlessness which somehow dehumanizes him. And there's a point that Rupert Fryer made on Twitter last night, but I think it's actually, you know, a very, very apt one, that Messi is constantly referred to as an alien. We just can't comprehend it. It's something beyond our comprehension. Whereas Maradona is God. There's a humanity to it. And that, I think, is the difference between them.
Marcelo, what was the reaction in Argentina when he got thrown out of the World Cup? I mean, he tested positive for ephedrine. Like, he shouldn't have done it, and it should have been, this is a bad thing. But I just wonder if the reaction was, it was an outrage against Maradona. I don't know.
Of course, yes. I mean, it was a big, big moment of mourning, I gather. I mean, I was in England working at the BBC, refusing to read the news because I didn't. I thought that maybe that would make it not be true. I mean, you know, seriously. It's just going, no, it hasn't been confirmed. And a producer going, if you don't read that news bulletin right now, I'm coming in and reading it myself. But it was a period of mourning, and there was a lot of conspiracy theories. And in fact, several books have been written, and a lot of people who felt that it was a CIA conspiracy, other people who felt it was, he himself would go, well, the corrupt United States have kicked me out of the game. But also, because of what Jonathan was saying right now, but the kind of unexplainable and understandable aspect of him, the alien, a lot of people in Argentina are quite comfortable saying, look, he cheated, he broke the rules, he's always doing that, he's just unreliable, for goodness sakes, stop defending him, how long for? And a lot of people are really quite disenamored with him. You know, it's not like he's a deity or a saint. It's not like the whole country is willing to get married holding the, Maradona's autobiography as the Bible and take vows on it. A lot of people, especially in more recent years, when he's continued to be a human, even though his kind of elite athleticism has been over, are quite comfortable saying, we don't think he's a god or a saint. And so that's interesting, because I think that split was really marked after 1994. There was a real division between people who went, oh, poor Diego, look what they've done to him now, and people who went, what the hell? That was a World Cup and you blew it for us.
I mean, the Roy Keane thing in Ireland almost caused a civil war. You know, it was so divisive. That's our equivalent.
I remember Willie Sanyol saying, you know, in the dressing room after the Zidane headbutt, he said, you know, you've ruined that for me. You know, you've got one of these and I don't, and you've ruined it. Anyway, look, that'll do for part two. Jonathan, I know you've got to go, but thanks for your input, as always.
Cheers.
See you again soon. Cheers. And Asif Kapadia, the director of the film Diego Maradona, will join us in just a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's bring in Asif Kapadia, director of the film Diego Maradona. Asif, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Max. Good to be on. Big fan of the show and nice to be here talking about the big man, Diego.
I wonder how many people have watched your film in the last 12 hours. I mean, so many people. Imagine you have, your phone has been ringing. I mean, it's a brilliant film. I know so many people have said that to you, and I'm not just saying it because you're on here. You spent some time with Maradona. What was he like?
So I met him quite a few times. I met the kind of latter-day Maradona. So he was living in Dubai. And the classic thing about Maradona is whenever you try and tell his story or you write a book about him, you write an article, or many people, even some people on this pod, previously may have written obituaries. And then he goes off and does something else, and you go, oh, I've got to rewrite that final chapter. So I met him in Dubai, and at one point it felt like that was some sort of closure. You know, here he is, he's in Dubai, in the middle of nowhere, living in a nice place, but it was really far away from everyone. And I, you know, it felt a little bit sad, but he was in a good way. He looked healthy, his brain was still there. He would kind of go off, and sometimes, I can't deny, he would kind of half fall asleep while we were talking. But when you got him at the right time, in the right moment, he was great. He was great. And, you know, he looked healthy. He looked like he should look at around 57, 58, around that time. And then, you know, from there, he ends up, I hear, oh, he's going to be in Belarus because he's coaching in Belarus. And then he ends up in Mexico, in Sinaloa. And then I'm glad he did finally end up back in Buenos Aires. I think that feels right that he's back there with around some of his family and back coaching. And he kind of did his final grand tour. I didn't see him then. I went to Buenos Aires. I tried to show him the film. I tried to meet with him. And by that point, the team around him, it was kind of impossible to get to him. So I had a tiny window of opportunity when I was able to spend time one-on-one with Diego Maradona.
And you must have watched, more footage of Maradona than possibly anyone else.
I think there's a few people out there. There's like his biographer, you know, Danny Larcucci, and a few people out there who would have seen a lot. But what we were able to get our hands on was this kind of the golden age in Napoli, which a lot of people had not seen before because, you know, it wasn't on TV. It's pre-Football Italia. Oh, am I allowed to say that? It was pre, you know, it was trans-world sport time. It's like you'd have 5 minutes for the rest of the world and you'd have the World Cup. And so to get footage close up of him on the pitch during that era and watching it, you know, really, really in detail and to be able to rewind and say, what did he just do there? How did he do that? I think we were very lucky in that way. And the sad thing about making films is only a small part of that ends up in a movie. There's all this other stuff that we saw. There's stuff that I found in Buenos Aires in Claudia, his ex-wife's home, that we didn't even get a chance to digitize. And I kept saying to her, these tapes are falling apart. You know, they're old U-matic tapes. You've got to let me digitize them. Even if I can't use them, even if you don't give me permission to use them in a film, they should be saved for the future generations. This is really iconic material. So yeah, we saw a lot of great stuff. I saw a lot of handballs, for example. You know, a lot of people in this country are going on about the hand of God. He did it four or five times. And sometimes he got away with it, and sometimes he didn't. You know, he was brilliant. He did diving headers with his hand right next to his head, and he'd push it in. He did a famous one against Zico. They played against one another in Italy, and he scored a goal, and he got away with it. And Zico was furious. So he wasn't a one-off. He was brilliant in so many ways, but he definitely did things like that more than once.
Asifa, just watching your documentary again last night, I would recommend it to everyone who hasn't seen it and to people who have to watch it again. But one thing I took away from it, there's so much footage of him surrounded by crowds, being, you know, looking quite frightened and intimidated, people pawing at him, everyone wants a piece of him. And the only time he really ever truly looks at peace in that documentary is when he's sort of on his own. There's one scene where I think he's sitting on the grass or sitting on a football on the grass, just looking up at the sky. And he said before, when he signed for Napoli, he wanted peace, a peace he never got at Barcelona. Do you think he ever, he certainly didn't get it in Naples, but did he ever find that peace?
I mean, I would say, yeah, the story is, you kind of put your finger on it. The story, the peace became the pitch. The piece became the ball. You know, that was always the piece. Whether when he was growing up, I think in Viaferrito, the very, very tough, poor place where he came from, you know, just doing kick-ups on his own, I think, is when he was most at peace. Him and a ball. And I guess the pitch became the way to escape from the crowd. Even though there were 80,000 people around him in the stadium in São Paulo, he would be able to have a moment where he was free. And I think it's like that classic thing, I guess, of artists or geniuses. You know, you have the thing that you love, and that's the moment of peace. Everything else comes with it, which you want. You need people to love you. You want people to want to be near you, because he needs that for his ego. But the other side of him also wanted to get away from it. And he didn't like being touched. He wasn't someone who liked to be grabbed. And of course, Napoli, Italy, Argentina, very touchy-feely places. So I think what we saw in the footage, and which we showed in the film, which we see, for me, the turning point is when he wins the World Cup and he comes home to Argentina and he's holding the World Cup. And literally, as he gets off the plane, everyone wants a piece of him, and that's the moment, I think, when his life changes. And you can see it in his eyes. You can see, and that's, I suppose, the power of cinema. You can show people's faces in close-up, and you can see he's afraid. You know, that's not the guy that we thought we knew, Maradona, is he? He looked scared, and he was a bit of a child.
I think that's really interesting, and it's beautifully conveyed in your film, as you say, with all the right images to kind of stress that. But in a way, he needed that asphyxia so much. It was almost like that was his essential primary addiction, that was the substance he abused. Because if he was on his own in a room somewhere, and I met him several times many years ago, where it was kind of easier to be at some party or at some place where Maradona was, and you could maybe end up sitting on a sofa chatting to him. But that, if he was on his own, he freaked out. So it's almost like that fear and that phobia of the crowd became worse if the crowd wasn't there. It's an extraordinary thing. But so, you know, I can't imagine him growing old in a quiet ranch somewhere, enjoying classical music and reading books, because I think that solitude would do his head in. And at the same time, you know, the excess of that, there's the crowds, the desperation, there's that kind of scene in Jesus Christ Superstar where they're all going, "Will you touch me and heal me, Christ?" And Jesus can't bear it. I always had that sense with Maradona where he would say, "Okay, we're stepping out into the street now. There will be a crowd," almost like he was on the pitch and could see it from above. He would worm his way through. And then he would be on his own at the other side and almost panic more than before he wandered into the crowd. And I feel in a way I'm watching the footage here in Buenos Aires now, and the hustle to get into the wake is the same again. And you think, gosh, even, you know, the guy's corpse can't escape this. It's one of the most extraordinary things I've witnessed, and I don't think I've ever seen it with anyone else.
Yeah, Asif, I was wondering, what kind of rating did your documentary get with the Board of Classification? Because honestly, there's so much violence in it.
On the pitch.
And I think on the pitch, yes. And I think one of the many things that I loved in the film is, in a way, we discovered Maradona because of your film, because these images we'd never seen before. We had no idea of how much, you know, we saw Goicoechea's assault, but we had no idea it was game after game after game that he was hacked all around the pitch, that it was game after game after game that he managed those extraordinary flights of fancy. And it was the first time, I think, we actually had an idea of the player. And what is extraordinary is that you've done a film which is contributing a lot to the legend and will contribute to the legend, but it's also the first film I've seen about him which is about the player, about the game, about the football, the actual football. You know, it's and which is, again, it seems to be impossible to disentangle one side, again, the Diego from Maradona, the football from the non-football, what's on the pitch, what's off the pitch. It seems to be impossible to do that.
Yeah, I think, thanks, Dilip. I mean, that was exactly the idea. In a way, it is about Diego Maradona, and it's about Diego, and it's about Maradona, which was our kind of big idea of how do we explain this character, which I think, in a way, Marcelo, you were talking about. Because he's the guy, if you leave him alone, because he says, I need peace, leave me alone. If you leave him alone, he'll start a fight. Because he can't be alone, right? It's like, why are you leaving me alone? You're fired. You know, I hate you. You stole from me. You know, that's his whole thing of he will create something because he needs that energy. He thrives off that energy. And I think, Philippe, the idea of the film, I guess, is I'm a child of the 70s and the 80s. So it's also kind of a love story to him, but also to football, the way it used to be. This is pre-Champions League. You know, this is pre, like, a few players who go to all the teams that are guaranteed to win the title for 10 years. You know, the best player in the world goes to the poorest city in Europe and wins a championship, the toughest championship there was, Italy in the 80s, with a team that never won before. Who's going to do that now? Nobody. And win the World Cup in the middle of winning those two championships with the best World Cup ever, with the best goal ever in a World Cup and the best bit of cheating in the World Cup. You know, who's going to do that? That's him. That's him. That's why you can't forget him. And in the meantime, living, you know, the way only he could, life to the max off the pitch. And so one of my favourite bits in the film is actually a point when he gets brutally tackled in Italy and he's crawling on the floor to chase after the ball so he can carry on running. No spinning around, rolling 15 times. He literally is like, I want to keep running. This is a good move here. That's how football used to be. And I think a lot of it was just to show that. And if you get kicked and if you get your ankles broken, if you get attacked and if you get elbowed, why wouldn't you use your hand to score a goal against those guys?
I don't really know what the answer to this question is, Marcella, but luckily I don't have to answer them. I just ask them, what do you think his legacy will be? Or do you think his legacy might have already started?
Yeah, I mean, of course it started. And certainly the football legacy. So there's a lot of this kind of romanticising and mystique building stuff about the, you know, what Asif is saying, that the football the boys loved in the 70s and the blood that Philippe noticed in the... It portrayed in the film, and the legacy of that football started obviously the minute he started playing, and remains in that way that football builds its own history as it happens, and we all have our memories and our emotions and our perceptions tied to every incident according to whatever's happening to us at that time. But in another sense, I think there's something quite important about Maradona, which is difficult to bring to light right now, because I think that the emotional moment of death means everybody, it's like a forgiveness in a way. You know, we now forgive him and wish him to rest. We can't hold anything against him. We can't hold any grudges. But I think some of the things that Maradona did, some of the ways he behaved towards women, towards his children, are incredibly important that we remain tuned into them and tuned into those kids and to those women who we're seeing weeping right now, as you know, some aren't allowed in to mourn him, some are far away, some have had to go to court. And I do think they are social issues that are very important. I was talking to a friend last night who said my daughter in her mid-20s is very angry about this kind of non-judgmental mourning. And I would hate for it to become a gender issue or a generational issue. I think if we can admire and uplift the flawed genius, we can also have him as a whole and allow that legacy to transmit to other generations about the importance of certain values and morals and things, not in a stupid kind of meanly puritanical way, not a mean morality, but the importance of battling the demons. Because I think in a lot of ways, a lot of Maradona's issues, whether it's substance abuse or womanizing or whatever excess he was in, could have been handled better by a better set of emotional tools around him. So we have it in our power to transmit a notion of what this game could lead to and could become. And I hope his legacy will, to some extent, be, look what happens if we don't do that.
I was just going to say, I think Marcel is so spot on, because the idea of the violence, it isn't just on the pitch, it's off the pitch. It's the idea of taking kids from one part of the world, giving them loads of money, chucking them on the opposite side of the world with no support. You know, which I'm hoping, not only did those awful tackles not happen now, and those pitches are not as bad as they were then now, the balls are different now, but also there is more support. So if you're going to buy a brilliant player from Latin America and bring him all the way to Europe and put him in Barcelona, don't treat them like crap. which is what happened to him. So then he ended up in Naples because he felt more supported there. But then he's surrounded by people who are, again, going to take advantage of him. And he's still a kid. He may well, you know, that's what I found when I made the film. I'm older than the kid that I'm watching. But when I was watching him as a fan, he was older than me. I thought he's a grown man. He must know what he's doing. But he realized he's still a child. He just is brilliant at football. And the idea of the support, when I look at, you know, the great coaches who are out there now, why would you make someone the most expensive player in the world and not put a support system around them, not help them manage everything else that's going on? I think that hopefully has changed and has improved because he really didn't have that support. So he's a street guy and he will find whatever way to survive wherever he is. And if you put him in Naples in the 80s, he's going to meet certain people and they're going to want to be hanging around with him and he's going to want to hang around with them. And you know, that's the idea. And everything you say, Marcelo, about the women and everything that he did, all we could show in our time period was one child that he for 30 years denied for 30 years. And that for me is a direct link to all of his issues with drugs and trying to get numb the pain, trying to get rid away from what he knows he's lying. And he keeps lying and it builds a lie upon a lie. And he lied to his daughters and he lied to his ex-wife. He lied to everyone and to himself. And that has, you know, there's a payback somewhere down the line. I think that's what happened. And then he did it again and he did it again and he did it again. And there are lots of children out there that didn't have him as a parent. And it was quite hard looking at that material and thinking, OK, are we going to go into that? You know, I did a previous film, Amy, where we dealt more with that side of her story. With Maradona, what we tried to do with our film was just to explain where he'd come from, what he'd been through, what he'd experienced, and say he's kind of broken. By the time he leaves Naples, he's not in a good way, and it only got worse for the next 20 years. The fact that he lived to 60 is a miracle. That is amazing because of what he'd done to his body, you know.
Well, Marcelo said there he didn't have the opportunity to do what the kind of thing Marcus Rashford has done recently, but there is a lovely story where on one occasion he asked FIFA and Napoli to organise a charity game to raise money for a child who was sick, and both refused. So he took it upon himself to get some players involved and organised an impromptu charity game on basically a patch of scrubland outside this child's house. And 4,000 people turned up to watch it, you know. So he had his flaws, but he also had a very kind heart.
Oh, no, he had a superbly kind heart, and he was very loyal, and he did incredible gestures. I don't mean to say he should have done what Marcus Rashford did. I meant to say he existed in a time where that was harder. I mean, the footage of the game in the match, I think, was one of the first things you showed me, Asif, when I first met you in Soho. It's such incredible imagery, and at the same time it's a little bit off the cuff and a little bit informal, and of course FIFA isn't going to respond. It's like the anecdote of him going to the Vatican and saying, "Oh Pope, you claim to be concerned about the poor, why don't you just sell the roof, beast or tiger or something?" You know, everything Maradona did, he was the only person involved in. He never got a movement going. He tried to do a players union, it was about him. He tried to take FIFA on board, it was about him. It has to do with education, with containment. It's exactly what Asif's saying. He leaves the country as a teenager on his own with a fur coat and earring, buys drugs and hangs out with the first bunch of kind of losers he meets. Then you get a new generation, Messi. What happens to him? His family go, "Yeah, but we're all going with him and we want school for the kids, jobs for the family and a certain amount of money." And little by little, we could, that's my point, just make it so that the children of football are helped to grow into all-round wholesome members of society and not just craving the celebritydom and the loneliness of being a superstar.
I'd love to finish the pod just hearing Philippe talk about Maradona's warm-up in that game that is everyone will have seen on YouTube, because we should end on the pitch with just what a genius he was.
Listen, I think the only thing I could say is that if you haven't seen it, watch it. It was before the it was in the return leg of the semi-final of the UEFA Cup, 1989-1990, with this Austrian disco hit pumping through the PA. And he's there encouraging, clapping, and then doing the most ridiculous I don't know, warm-up. You can't call it a warm-up. You know, you remember what we said about Claude Gentile said football is not for ballerinas. He was so fucking wrong. Football is for ballerinas, especially if they danced like Diego Maradona. And I think that's my conclusion.
And I think that's everyone's conclusion. Thank you, Philippe. Thanks, everyone, for coming on. Asif, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Marcella, thank you.
Lovely to see you all.
Barry, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
We'll be back, I presume, with a much more mundane podcast about football that's happened on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.